No, I mean, this is part of the sort of subtlety, or the when I was saying it was much more subtle, that I didn't realize I was being infiltrated, because I always thought I was a rebel from Crowleyanity too. Like, I read the books and I took on certain of the archetypes and certain of the and so on, but I felt like I was rejecting Crowley and Thelema per se, because I was never a joiner. But of course, that's how, you know, that you close the front door to the devil, he comes in the back door, right?
How long did you last within your kind of occult journey?
I would say that my occult journey started unconsciously, well, I mean, not counting childhood programming, which I'm not ruling out, started semi-consciously when I was an adolescent with David Bowie and stuff, and all of that stuff, but not in terms of anything like practicing magic. Became fully conscious when I read Castaneda at 21, and then that lasted through to my late 30s when I had, well, let me think, actually, it was mid to late 30s, because I had something like a psychotic break in my early 30s. It's actually right before 9/11. So around 9/11, I started to come out of the fog, I'd say.
Do you think that that break was due to your involvement in kind of occultism?
It was, and I can't separate it from psychedelics. I was using a lot of psychedelics, which of course is part of what Crowley, you know, the legacy of Crowley. So, right. So yeah, it was all of a piece, really.
Together, right? Interesting.
Yeah.
Did you, I mean, during that era, did you come across, so your brother was friends with or associated with Piorge. Did you see those groups, those kind of underground?
I was blissfully ignorant of all of that. Like, my brother's life was this dark mystery to me that had this allure. I would even sneak into his bedroom, and you know, and I wasn't allowed in his bedroom, and he, you know, he was too much older than me for me to ever, you know, hang around with him, and basically I was just persona non grata in his world. So I just got glimpses, and I had no idea what I was glimpsing until, even until just a few years ago, that I started to remember that throbbing gristle picture on his wall. And then he wrote a memoir. My brother would be interesting to you as a case study too, because he, it's a bit like I was saying about Crowley, that his rebellion in a way was to bring to the front and make visible these kind of luciferic practices that are part of the aristocratic, you know, hidden lifestyle. So he actually became openly satanic, as in he wore a red suit with a red top hat. Before that, he got crucified in the Philippines, so he was doing his Christ thing, but as an atheist. It's very complicated, actually.
So your brother was, how long did his kind of occult journey last? The same, like 15 years? Was he in the same kind of?
Well, no, this is actually unknown, because, and this is part of what I'm trying to investigate, because he would denied it. Like, I don't know what he got up to in his teenage years and his early 20s, because by the time he and I were friends, his identity and his persona was virulently anti-occult and virulently materialistic and nihilistic. He loved Nietzsche, but he despised Crowley, and he mocked and scorned any kind of belief in the occult. So my guess is that's because he got burned by it.
What do you think the prevalence of Crowley is in affecting the lives of young UK, you know, kids or teens? How many people actually come across Crowley? Is it kind of a rarefied group of people, or is it like, you know, a significant proportion of the youngsters kind of come across or read Crowley? Do you know?
Well, I certainly don't know anything in terms of numbers, obviously, and percentages, but and it depends. Like, you've covered in the Children of the Beast, right, very well, because if you include, you know, second and third degree burns, so to speak, exposure to Crowley through secondary or tertiary causes, influences, then it's everyone. Like, you know, if you include Alan Moore and David Bowie and so on, everybody's been influenced by Crowley at this point.
Yeah, they just see it.
But and then, but a small, well, not a small percentage, a percentage, they find their way directly to Crowley, no doubt about it. I mean, black, or not black magic, shouldn't call it that, because that, then that's easy to dismiss by the occultists, right? But occultism, whatever, it really is has such a strong appeal, as you know, to disenfranchised adolescents.
Right. So, you know, there's a specific proportion, a small number of your people you grew up with who knew Crowley, and you know, people got into the occult, probably just like me. You know, I had people in my, where I lived in Northern California, who I knew were involved in Topi because they shaved their head and had that little ponytail going out the back of their head. Do you remember how those guys used to dress?
The Temple of Psychic Youth. No, I don't actually.
They would shave their head kind of like monks or something, and then grow a long kind of ponytail down the back of their head. So I know people who got into that, who were, you know, affected by their ideology.
I think it's so insidious and so prevalent, in terms of there just being a universal thing, which is in the culture as we have it, kids, particularly male kids, grow up into adolescence, enter into adolescence with a feeling of alienation and disempowerment, and they look for something that will make them feel powerful, and there it is, the occult. It's absolutely tailor-made for that, exactly that.
Very true. Very true.
And of course, whether it's the Beatles or whether it's the slightly darker Alice Cooper or Ozzy Osbourne, there's a kind of spectrum in terms of popular media. It's all embedded. It all has that kind of value set embedded into it.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think that it's just always going to be there for generation to generation until the end of the world. There always will be a specific proportion of those young kids, which is probably seems to be getting more popular now with, you know, the advent of Harry Potter and all that. So
Right.
always will be just another generation and another action. I mean, we see in the United States is kids in MS-13 did some satanic ritual. So, you know, it's around. They were young.
Yeah, I think it's pro I mean, it's occurring to me, it's because you included Harry Potter or J.K. Rowling in your people, Children of the Beast, and so that's a great example in terms of something that could hardly seem less malign, right? Unless you're a hardcore Christian who, just anything sorceress is malevolent, right? But for most, secular people, Harry Potter seems harmless. But of course, it is a vehicle for this basic ideology of the will to power.
Yes.
And I think that, I mean, what one of the things I'm exploring is that we often tend to mistake effect for cause. And kind of miss. So, for example, like if we think of occultism or Satanism as something that causes derangement or ego inflation or this pathological will to power and so on and so forth, then we might be missing the boat in terms of understanding how prevalent it is, because I think it's the reverse. I think that there's something in our traumatized civilization now that drives us like a pathogen to try and become powerful because of trauma. And so Satanism and all the rest of it are actually causes. I mean, they're effects, not causes. They're symptoms of something that's already in us. You see what I mean? So then we find, yeah.
I've actually thought on those lines. I've always thought that a lot of those traumas are predicates to people getting into the occult. So, you know, these traumatic experiences are what drive people to do stuff like that. So I think that I've always thought maybe that there was an influence to traumatize people, thereby, you know, creating an interest in will to power and the ideology of the Satanists, you know.
And of course, it's becoming so prevalent now that I don't know if you looked at this After Satan Schools thing. Oh, you did, didn't you? a little bit, and how what I noticed in that was this overlap between the new Satanism or the new whatever it is, whatever phase of Satanism we're at now or stage. It's like feminism, right? We have third stage Satanism. It's almost synonymous with neoliberalism now.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible.
So it's that prevalent. And it relates to identity politics, and I think, and this idea that, and this is my brother's philosophy, you are what you pretend to be.
Interesting.
What you say you are is what you are, and you can enforce that now with identity politics. You can say, you can accuse someone of hate crime if they don't go along with your definition of who you are. Well, that's very similar to the satanic,
Philosophy.
yeah, whatever we're going to call it, because I'm not a Christian, so I don't necessarily. I see Satanism more as a psychological thing than a worship of an entity, but I think that they're two sides of the same coin. And so in psychology, it has to do with negative identity, how we define ourselves by what we're not, as a reaction against. It's always a reaction against something. And so the negative identity is this fortress of solitude that protects us. That's created through trauma. We're traumatized, and so we take refuge in a dissociated state, and we have to keep that bubble intact by constantly pushing against something or finding things to define us that we're not, as a rebellion against things. And so then the identity politics is kind of that. Like, you have these minorities that rise up and say, I'm gay, or I'm trans, or I'm this, I'm that. And they're basically opposing the status quo, but they're demanding that the status quo validate them at the same time.
Right, indeed. I mean, to make those changes, you have to validate their position.
Yeah.
So whatever it is, whatever you're, where you are on the 47 different spectrums of sexuality or wherever, or race, you know. So yeah, I mean, I think that this will be a passing phase, this kind of identity politics, because it's already kind of petering out. People aren't really buying it. So, and the pol I think that that's why one of the reasons why Trump went into power is partially because of what was happening for so, you know, in the States for the last 8 years or whatever under Trump.
Yeah, well, I think there's a thing, I call it the pendulum, but it swings. But Lloyd DeMaus talks about this, the psychohistorian, how the what arose in Germany in the 30s with National Socialism was a psychological response, reaction to the Weimar Republic period of real freedom, seeming social freedom and libertarian values, because there's something in traumatized psyche that panics if it has too much freedom.
Interesting.
And so
Yeah.
then it clamps down with the opposite, right?
Yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, that whole fluctuation from post-war Germany through the Weimar Republic and then back to Hitler
Yeah.
was something else. I mean, just total. I mean, you couldn't really. I mean, the spectrum that was switched from was something, you know, incredible.
Yeah.
Chaos, semi-stability, freedom of the Weimar Republic, and then total control under Hitler, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting that Hitler, Crowley was in Weimar, you know, in Weimar from 30 to 33, in and out, and you know, it's interesting that some of his followers tried to contact Hitler, and some did. So I mean, Crowley was probably sending information back about Hitler back to, you know, the Secret Intelligence Service, the SIS, while he was there, probably the whole time.
Yeah, speaking of the SIS, there's actually two ways I wanted to go here, two really interesting paths.
Semper Occultus, that's their motto.
Is
Or the
that?
MI6. MI6 is Semper Occultus, yeah.
Oh. Which is what? Always hidden?
Always hidden, always secret, I think.
Right. Well, there's two ways I want to go, so we can't go both, but I will mention the first one, and one which was what you were saying about Crowley and Hitler, that it somewhat reconciles the seeming paradox about Crowley being all about freedom, but having these very
Control.
totalitarian, tyrannical ideology in terms of social control and all the rest of it. So he might have even been promoting freedom precisely as a long-term strategy to bring in the systems of control.
Yeah, perhaps, absolutely. I mean, don't you think this craziness of the Weimar, the cabaret and all that stuff and the license that was happening, added to Crowley, that may, I mean, added to Hitler, that people didn't reject it as much because they might have wanted to get out of it.
Yeah.
The sterility of Nazi ideology.
Yeah, that's in the movie Cabaret, isn't it? That contrast, those two
Yeah.
cult.
And I think that, the writer of Cabaret, what was his name? I can't
It was
remember.
it Isherwood?
Isherwood, yeah. So Christopher Isherwood,
He knew
Party with
Crowley,
Crowley. Yeah,
yeah.
Party with Crowley. I have a quote of his. If you look at my like David Bowie video, the reason David Bowie went to Berlin is on the because he was enamored with Christopher Isherwood's diaries. I think he wrote Berlin Diaries, which the Cabaret was based on. And there's a part, it's interesting because Isherwood made his way to, he was gay, he made his way to LA and found this guy, basically the guy who was his boyfriend is still here, kind of close to where I live on the west side. But it's interesting that there's actually a video of Christopher Isherwood in Santa Monica pointing to Aldous Huxley's house. So all these guys who kind of knew Crowley or were in the orbit of his friends ended up in LA. Aldous
Right.
Huxley, Isherwood, there's just tons of other. I got to get my list, but I mean, this one girl who was at the Abbey of Philema that I include in Children of the Beast, Jane Wolfe came here. Hubbard ended up here. So it's LA was kind of the nexus, the post Crowley nexus of people came to LA.
Tredegar was finding out that he would host these parties where the black masses occurred, but it wasn't necessarily known, the black mass part, obviously, but these parties where Huxley and H.G. Wells and Augustus John and J.K. Chesterton even
Wow.
would hang out there. And then, and
That's good.
so yeah, that reminded me of this Tredegar, and then I realized that Crowley was connected to that. And then, of course, Crowley and, well, what you're talking about here with Crowley and Huxley and so on.
So you're the first person to mention Augustus John in an interview. So congratulations. That was in Children of the Beast, but I'm amazed that that was in this guy Tredegar's book. I'll have to read it.
The Augustus John, yeah, there isn't a book about Tredegar, and he wasn't in the Robert Bryan's book, I don't think. I can check the index, but I didn't really register who Augustus John was until the last week or so. And you know how when you see a name and then it comes up again and a third time, and then you realize, oh wait a minute, that's that same one, right? And he's showing up at this party and that party, and so yeah, that was the case with John. And it's interesting, you know, what it's interesting what I find with this research is that information that wasn't meaningful to me a year ago, or certainly 10 years ago, it becomes massively meaningful at a
Interesting.
certain point once I'm ready for it and once I have other pieces in place. So, with Crowley, I mean, what my experience is like, and what it's good to talk to someone like yourself, is that it's like the elephant in the room. Like, there's so much incontrovertible evidence about what Crowley really was and what he was up to that once I'm seeing it, I just can't believe that I was in the dark for as long as I was.
I mean, it's the, what is it, the attraction of evil or whatever. Why are, I mean, I think, why are people attracted to the, some of those values that Crowley, really thought were ideal? Deification of the self, drugs.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, you can say the whole 60s was kind of like an ode to Crowley, according to Timothy Leary. But yeah, it's not that uncommon. I think that so many, I think that Crowley's intent was to create a dynamic where people would be attracted to his ideas,
Well, because that's what everyone does if he's trying to propagate something. But I think with Crowley, that again, back to this thing that he created a very convincing a semblance of being this independent agent of rebellion and revolt, when in fact he was an instrument. Well, of course he would have agreed with that part, right? He claimed to be an instrument of a god, and who knows about that, but he was certainly an instrument of the ruling class. I've got no doubt about that at all. And so, of course, then he's got the whole apparatus of the hierarchy behind him.
And supported him. I mean, he was always able to go back into England. He always had seemed to, survive a little bit. I don't know if he ever got a pension, but he called him, what did he call himself in his confessions? He said he was what, John Sykes' dog from Oliver. Remember all the book Oliver from, but by Dickens, and John Sykes beats his dog, and the dog always comes back. Crowley called himself that dog.
Oh,
His relationship to England.
right. Interesting, yeah. I guess you read Spence's Agent 666.
Yes, definitely. I was in. It was a great book. Great other piece of putting one of the some of the puzzle of Crowley together, and the fact that he found out that the United States government knew that Crowley was a spy, at that time was
Yeah.
a very important aspect of Crowley. I mean, you kind of put the pieces together from confessions, but having that objective kind of third party fact is awesome.
Well, what I haven't actually read it, but I've been looking at it online, and what stood out for me in that, what was incredibly useful, was the part of Kim Philby, you know, who was part of the Cambridge set. Okay, so people who don't know, it was Guy Burgess and Anthony Blunt and a couple of others, these double agents who were working for MI5 but also reporting to the Soviet. So, you know, part of regular history timeline. Anyway, so Philby, in his reports to the Soviet Union, and this Spence includes this in his book, reports how there were these black masses being arranged by intelligence. He's not too clear which one, maybe German, maybe British, maybe both, as a means to lure agents and other powerful or influential people and compromise them into compromising situations, photograph them and blackmail them and have control over them, which is something Nick Bryant writes about in the Franken scandal. It's pretty much well known now in terms of the MO of these, you know, the child abuse rings, as part of how they do it or why they do what they do, right? So
they all do it. I mean, I talked to Corinne Hutz about, who was the, she was involved in everything that went down in Belgium with the Dutroux, you know, the Dutroux affair.
Yeah.
And she told me that, you know, everything happening with Pedogate, 90% of it is blackmail.
Right.
She thought, and you know, I tend to agree with that. It makes the most sense.
It does. Not that it's only that. It doesn't have to be only one thing. It's clearly that this is a case of, you know, many different ends being achieved through a single strategy, because of course there's the child porn industry, and then there's the traumatization of infants and so on. There's just many different gains here for the people behind them. But anyway, bring it back to Philby. But then he names Crowley. Crowley is a key player in these black masses that are set up as a means to blackmail agents and other people. And then I found out right after that Tom Dryberg, I don't know where I read this now, but I can find out. He read Diary of a Drug Fiend, and because in that Crowley apparently writes about parties and getting high society women to the parties and drugging them and getting them into sex orgies. I don't know. I haven't read it for a long time. But according to Dryberg, Crowley was doing that himself as a way to blackmail these women.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
See that reference wherever you can find that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I can find it right now if you want for the listeners, but certainly I can send it to you.
That'd be great. I mean, the you know, I think I wrote in Children of the Beast, and then Dryberg is working with John le Carré, you know, David Cornwell, the guy who wrote Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, that kind of covers. Mm-hmm. So he's, you know, the basically the Cambridge Five, and Dryberg was hanging out with Burgess. Dryberg actually, one of his covers was as a journalist. So he went to Russia and talked with Burgess. Burgess died shortly thereafter, which is interesting.
That was Dryberg you're talking about?
Dryberg, yeah. Went to Russia.
Right.
And then actually the interesting thing about Cornwell, he's coming out with a new book under John le Carré, but the story in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy about what happened in Hungary, I think it's the guy that was based on a real story of a spy exchange, and the son of that guy involved in the real story is working in the Trump administration.
Wow.
As the Hungarian guy, I wish I could remember his name, but he wrote like an anti-Islam book, but his dad was involved actually in kind of this Cold War spy.
Right.
No, it was Knight's protege. So Cornwell was the spy boss's protege. So I'm sorry, I made a mistake. It was Knight's protege was David Cornwell.
This is Maxwell Knight.
Yeah, Maxwell Knight, thanks.
Right. So, yeah, so bringing it back to that nexus then. So Maxwell Knight was friends with Crowley, or again, friends isn't the word, is it, but accomplices. And so it was in the Philby report, I have to just read it otherwise I get lost. As regards authenticity, the people identified in Philby's notes and the charts really existed, and similarly the nightclubs mentioned, because the, you know, the black masses and the whatnot were mostly done in nightclubs in London and elsewhere, mentioned also operated during the war, so there is an element of verisimilitude to a rather bizarre tale that links the notorious occultist Aleister Crowley to, of all people, the Soviet ambassador Ivan Maisky. Maisky lived in London during World War II, was close friends with George Bernard Shaw, H.G. Wells and Beatrice and Sidney Webb, so he was in the Fabian thing, which I've looked at a lot. And the thing that I was quoting you before, just to get that on record, it was from Bryant's again, that the dust has never settled, and he wrote, "Many people beside me have pointed out that the boys' bodies are temples of the Holy Ghosts, No, sorry, that boys' bodies are temples of the Holy Ghost, but on consecrated ground they bugger those temples, sometimes drugging the boys before sex as part of the black mass. The Sussex police knew, as I did, that some of the drug traffic in and out of the country was run by people who had been introduced to drugs via the black mass. Alistair Crowley wrote the band Diary of a Drug Fiend, and Dryburgh added that, quote, it was alleged that he lured well-known women to those orgies, drugged them until they participated, and then had them photographed for blackmailing purposes.
Incredible.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is so significant because it, to me, because it indicates a continuum between what Crowley was doing as part of his work for intelligence, German or British or both, as part of the general, you know, strategy of intelligence networks, and what he was doing apparently on his own for fun, right?
Right. So they overlap, right?
Yeah. So they're probably just the same thing, really.
Still in service, doing his rituals, but still giving stuff to the government and blackmailing people. Yeah, that's remarkable. And you know, you see the tie-ins, probably something similar happened with this whole pedo-gate, and it wouldn't be surprising at all if we found out that John Podesta was a member of the OTO.
Mm-hmm. No?
You know, I'm actually just waiting for that fact. I mean, somebody sent him an email that said, do a thelema for me. So he's using Crowley's kind of ideas. And, you know, he's hanging out with Peter Lavenda, talking about UFOs and stuff like that. So Lavenda's associated with the OTO, if not an OTO member. So,
well, Lavenda, as you know, if you saw the video, he attended a ritual that was filmed for Discovery Channel. His version, of course, is, you know, he was just invited as a friend to participate.
I just have friends. They all happen to be in the OTO. I'm not one of them.
Yeah, deniable plausibility, whatever it's called. Plausible deniability. it's yeah.
Strange world, man.
It really is.
He's denied everything. He's denied that he's the writer of the Necronomicon, but if you look, he acts copyright law. You can just write a book and copyright protects you, right? Or you can go to the patent and trademark office of the United States and trademark your book. So it's kind of like belt and suspenders. You're covered twice if you do it.
Hmm.
But somebody has the document of his, you know, the document that was put into the trademark office trademarking that book under his real name, under Peter Lavenda. So it's out there.
Yeah, I know. And more besides. And so it begs the question of why the denial, or why be so blatant if you're then going to deny it? You know, why not just cover your tracks better? And I think
true.
I think it's more than a rhetorical question, because I think that it's part of the mystification and the sort of generation of interest, which of course makes me a bit ambivalent about investigating some of this stuff, because I wonder if I'm just, you know, adding fuel to the fire by stirring the controversy or not. You know, my aim, of course, is to expose the lies, not because I'm on a mission for justice exactly, or maybe it is that in a way, but just because I want to find out the truth. Like, just,
well, it's all shielded, right? So, I mean, I think yeah. that he's denied it. He puts interesting things into his books. I've read his trilogy.
Yeah.
Sinister Forces. And he has little hints and inside jokes on that book. So, you know, and then he worked at The Magical Child, right?
Yeah.
The bookstore in New York. The guy's name was it Slater, was the a guy who had a gay lover, and they were both mad magicians. So he tells stories of being in that occult bookstore, talking to people and being part of that community. So.
Yeah, well, he's known to have appeared as Simon there. I think he'll even admit that he did pretend to be Simon, but he's just going to insist that he's not. He's not actually Simon.
Right. But if you read the Necronomicon, it's couched as if it's an old book, if I remember. I read it a long time ago. But, you know, it's not. They make it play it off like it's an ancient tome when it was written, you know, in the 70s or 80s.
Right. So the maintenance of the illusion that there is a Simon who is not Peter Lavenda seems somehow inextricably bound up in the maintenance of the illusion that the Necronomicon is a genuine magical tome.
Exactly.
And the Necronomicon, I mean, when you were asking about Crowley and how much had influenced young people in Britain, the first thing that came into my head was the Necronomicon, because not because I saw it around when I was growing up, but because I certainly know that in the US it's the book that is just on about every other, bong smoking, pimple faced adolescent's bookshelf, right? It's
Yes, I would say Necronomicon is what people get first, or they go to LaVey. If they're interested in the cult, they get the Satanic Bible or the Necronomicon. That's like their first step, probably.
Right. So this is not random. I mean, if there are specific advantages in propagating this ideology and inseminating it in people's psyches, then the vehicles that are most effective for doing so haven't come about randomly. It seems to me, the Necronomicon is so key, is so central. So then Lavender's involvement in it all makes him highly suspect. And then when you add to that all of his denials and all of his dissemblings around it, and then when you add to that his defense of Crowley, and it just gets more and more
And he's
suggestive.
done, he's done interviews with the OTO, some OTO chapter online. So, not too many people who aren't part of that group would probably go on there. So you can
Right.
find that interview as well. It's somewhere. I got to dig it up. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I don't know if you know this story, but when I wrote Prophet of Evil, after I wrote that, Trine Dey wrote a book based upon my research called The Most Dangerous Book in the World.
Oh,
Yeah, and
and
so
Lavender wrote something
wrote a
for
piece
that.
of that. Well, and if you read it, it basically is a direct repeat of my general thesis that Crowley's ideas were numerically involved. They just switched it up and used a different word called the Crowley Code. And S.K. Bain comes out of Washington. He was worked for, what's his name? Some kind of chicken hawk warmonger in D.C. And what they did to that book, he and Lavenda, if you read the book, the last third of it is all these ideas pertaining to like a nuclear bomb in Nevada based upon pseudo-numerology. It's just total fluff that nothing that ever came true.
Right.
So it could be called fear porn. And so I had somebody actually send something to me going, "Hey man, these guys are just muddying the waters. They're actually taking your thesis and making new conclusions that are based upon a phantasm, that are totally mythical nonsense." And all that stuff really was turned out to be nothing ever really happened. It wasn't based upon anything in reality. So I found it very interesting that that Lavenda was involved in that kind of twisting of my general thesis. I'm just an independent writer. I don't have everything you see in my books is me edited, all the graphics, everything, which you can tell that it's done homemade. But actually, my first book, when I wrote Prophet of Evil, my first books were actually printed out on a printer. So that was 6 or 7 years ago. But yeah, so that was I had you know that's kind of my strange two steps away connection to Peter Lavenda through Trine Dey Publishing.
Fills with blood. Yeah, the dogs now they howl as the street fills with blood. As your body drifts by. Thank you. how it will be. For the promise of water, I'll walk on my knees.
That is very interesting, and I've been dubious about Trine Day for some time, and about Chris Milligan too, and lately I have to say even Nick Bryant, because I had a very, I don't know how to account for it, but I reached out to him and wanted to talk to him, and he did talk to me on the phone off the record, and he agreed to do a couple of podcasts with me, and he acknowledged knowing Lavender, and that he acknowledged my disagreement with Lavender. He seemed friendly enough. And then he just completely stopped answering my emails.
Interesting.
And in the meantime, I asked Trine Day to send me his books, and they'd said yeah, but they never did. And so I just definitely got a weird feeling around that.
Interesting. Well, my understanding of Milligan is that he's also done something similar that happened with my book, which he's taken kind of research and tweaked it on somebody's book on Skull and Bones. And the guy who wrote the book earlier, can't remember his name now, but he had written, there was another book on Skull and Bones that you know, Chris Milligan, I heard, drew information from, and then, you know, kind of wrote his own book based upon that. It was by Anthony Sutton. So Sutton wrote a book going back like 2004, and then Milligan wrote a book kind of on the same thing.
Right. And they just brought out a book on Tavistock, which I skimmed, and from what I've heard is not very good. Let's just put it in fairly neutral terms. And you know, I when I was writing Occult Yorkshire, I never took Tavistock particularly seriously, because it seemed that most of it came through LaRouche and Coleman, and you know, that's all kind of tainted. So I just, whatever, I wasn't looking for anything, but I just found so much compelling evidence that Tavistock is directly implicated in these agendas and these programs. But it was, you know, I wasn't joining the dots or creating some vast Illuminati conspiracy theory. I was just finding the evidence and presenting it, and it's very compelling without jumping to conclusions. So my, you know, my sense has been for a long time now, but this seems to be confirming it more and more, that when you can't suppress information, which you can't in the age of the internet, really, the next best thing is preempt it by presenting it in a way that miscontextualizes it, you know, that puts it in a context that discredits it.
Right. Which, yeah, is like straw man arguments, or things where they say you said something where you didn't really say it. You know, I've seen things like that, supposedly based upon your saying blah blah blah. So yeah, there's all kinds of techniques they use.
Yeah,
that's enough. That's a good.
Yeah, if you can include a bunch of really good information, but then you tie it together in a way that is premature and not well argued and all the rest of it, it can have the effect of just tainting all of that information. So that sounds like what happened with your book. I mean,
yeah,
what they did to your work, rather.
Yeah. I mean, I think basically they did that to my research, because my if you look at the last part of my book and their book, it's totally different conclusions based upon Crowley's evidence. It's really something else. It's actually night and day. So, I wasn't very pleased about that, but I figured, you know, they can. I don't have any, you know, copyright laws or anything I could really enforce in that regard.
So you didn't contact any of them?
No, I have no contact with them, but I think people know, you know, I've done some interviews. I was on a couple shows 5 years ago, and then SK Bain went on it, and somebody said, didn't William Ramsey say the same thing? And so I was kind of, I got a little bit of, you know, semi-justification from that, but yeah, you know, yeah, I was disappointed by it. So, you know, the thing is, people could contact me. If they want to publish my book, a publisher can contact me. Maybe they don't think my books are good enough. I don't know. But they thought my research was good enough for that book.
Well, Trine Day doesn't really have much of a reputation as a publisher, though.
I didn't know that. I mean, what reputation have you heard?
Well, I guess I'm maybe speaking a bit out of turn. See, my wife doesn't like. They don't have a good reputation with my wife. When I look at the list and I look at the covers and I look, you know, I just think, because I thought about contacting. In fact, I did contact them once a while back about getting published, just because there's so few publishers to go to, right? But I was even in two minds then, and certainly since then, and even before I started thinking that there was something dodgy there. It's just this kind of sensationalist. I just think you can really do a discredit to the information if you present it in a way that is, as I'm saying, it that sensationalizes it, that oversimplifies it, that strips it of nuance, and I just I think that they have that kind of reputation, really, of a, you know, they bring out these edgy books about conspiracy theory and stuff, but they don't really have a lot of credibility in terms of being, they're not a scholarly press, that's for sure. And it is possible to, you know, the stuff that I'm publishing this year, God willing, if it goes through, the first one is Prisoner Infinity about Strieber and Kripal and the whole UFO scam, as I think of it. And the other one's about the organized abuse and occultism and Crowley and stuff. This is with a academic press in the UK, but they're going to do them as trade, so they're not going to be $40. And they're and they publish stuff on ritual abuse and stuff. So, but you know, good research, scholarly stuff, not just sensationalist stuff that's thrown together. And it's not just about having this sort of credibility, it is that, but also that I can see why, because they're really stringent about all the citations and just making sure everything is right. They really care. And that, I mean, I feel that way. Like, I found a couple of books recently on ritual abuse that are from scholarly presses, and it's such a breath of fresh air, you know, to read.
I listened to your podcast about the Cheit book, Cheit. That was, I think, from Brown, right? Didn't you publish that through Brown or Berkeley?
I can look right now, but that was definitely a scholarly one.
Tried to get in contact with him. He wouldn't call me back.
Oxford University Press. Yeah, I barely got a response from him either. He didn't want to talk to me, and I wonder about that. Yeah, because there is, in the book, he dismisses some of the more outrageous, what he thinks are outrageous satanic stuff, and I was definitely going to challenge him on that. Like, why? What's your basis for that? But on the other hand, the book does a great service in terms of showing that satanic panic itself is a big lie, and there was a reality that was causing the panic.
Well, it's interesting because I came across that argument in when I was doing my West Memphis 3. Well, I was done with my West Memphis 3. People kept banning me. This is all satanic panic. This is all, you know, just you in that. But then in that book, I had tons, and actually in the court records, there were just volumes of information showing the occultism and Satanism of these guys, and you know, their occultism and Satanism ended up with the death of 3 8-year-old kids. So they took it very seriously, and they also bandied about witch hunt. That was a common phrase. You're a witch hunter. I got called a witch hunter and all this stuff. And
yeah.
It was nonsense. I mean, they really didn't want to look at the actual facts or the evidence that the investigators compiled about that case.
Yeah, well, I've been getting it too, as you might have seen from Lavender. I got accused of being on a witch hunt, and it's funny, you know, how these phrases, because they're coming up in the UK all the time now, it's like a mantra.
Yes, yeah. You just right at you. Conspiracy theorist, witch hunt, satanic panic. Yeah, it's all there.
And it's weird, because does it do the work that they think that it does or not? It's really hard to say, because it's got all of this, it's got this narrative behind it. It's like you just say these two words and they have an association in people's minds, like a whole story, right? You say witch hunt, you say satanic panic, and it brings up all these already installed or established ideas about poor innocent witches being burned, poor innocent teachers losing their jobs, and right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that that's the point. So I think that if you have the time, I think that it's important to look past those phrases and see what actually happened in those in specific cases. Like in McMartin, I think something really did happen there. So, I mean, they actually convicted them on the second trial. And I've actually tried, I talked to Magali. She lives actually pretty close to me. And all the evidence there showed that something was going on, all those kids. And actually, the cover up, a couple people died, some cops died. But there was a, supposedly a whole network of nasty stuff happening in McMartin. Didn't Chait say that McMartin was valid?
Yeah.
You read that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, he questions some of the more outlandish tales, like there's one about a floor opening up and there being an alligator down there. Well, I don't know. Even there, I would say, well, you know, don't you want to just check that, you know, it's not impossible. So, but you'll always find that. There's always this a credibility problem around these stories, period. You know, just like, okay, so the latest one in the UK is Ted Heath, who was Prime Minister for 4 years of England. He's been implicated now. He was implicated by David Icke 10, 20 years ago, I don't know what. But now he's being implicated by the police investigation. He's dead. It's destabilizing for a country. We can talk about it as a collective, you know, a whole nationality of people, a whole society of people, to start taking on board the idea that a guy they voted into office and thought was a great leader and a great hero was doing acts that are difficult to think about at all. You know, they're difficult even to think about Ted Bundy doing, never mind a guy that you thought was a benevolent leader. So when you've already got that innate psychological resistance to seeing the truth, then you can throw... You can throw a Band-Aid at that gushing, you know, gaping wound with witch hunt written on it. Then people will grab for it and stick it on the wound, even though it's completely ineffective, and feel like they've done something, I guess.
Well, hopefully those concepts will go by the wayside, because in those cases, Heath, there's probably evidence there. But Jimmy Savile was actually buried like a witch, facing 45 degrees. He put his coffin at 45 degrees and faced the ocean. So, I mean, he's basically saying he was a witch, which he was, a male witch, a warlock.
Whatever, self-identify, I don't know, but, yeah, practicing the dark arts, for sure. And, you know, this does all, I mean, the more I hear witch hunt thrown at real attempts to investigate and expose these kind of occultic crimes, the more it makes me wonder if was there ever a witch hunt that wasn't justified. You know, maybe history's been rewritten from the start, like to make us think that, because, you know, the idea that people would just get into this moral panic and start hallucinating demons and, you know, symptoms of sexual abuse, and that children would start telling stories, that in itself is so hard to believe.
Well, here in the States, it's all witch hunt is almost always connected to the Salem witch trials and what happened in Salem. And, you know, then people are informed by the Crucible, Henry Miller, that it was all hokum. And, but if you look at the record, they actually had the book, The Witch's Hammer, what was the name of it? And Tituba, the lady who was from the Caribbean, was practicing all kinds of strange stuff. So weird stuff was happening, and Mather was the guy who went to Salem. People, the Christian authorities went to Salem to see what was going on. So, you know, there may have been some kind of witchcraft where these kids got possessed.
Yeah.
That's really it. And, I mean, those guys took it seriously enough to investigate what was happening in Salem. So.
Right. And then there's the Affaire de Poisons, or how you pronounce that in France, Affaire de Poison, or something like that. Did you hear about that?
Is that when the wheat gets mold on it or something?
No, that was, I don't know if there's a name for that, but yeah, that was when all those people were hallucinating. This was actually a satanic sect that was committing all of these murders and sacrifices and all the rest of it. I can't actually find the. I could look it up on Wiki, but anyway, it was in the 17 or the 1800s.
Interesting.
But it's a historically documented case. And then there's Gilda Rice, how we pronounce right. that. This guy who was, you know about that guy.
France, they call him Gilles de Montmorency, which I can't pronounce, Montmorency, because that's where it's from.
Oh, yeah?
Crowley actually wrote a talk about Gilles de Rice.
A defense of him, yeah.
Yeah, and he was supposed to give a talk, which was got banned. So he called it the banned lecture, Gilles de Rice, where he... But the evidence for that guy is voluminous, too. 500 young kids killed. Turned to acid, actually, which is, people talk about how they get rid of these bodies, and that guy carbonized his victims.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So bringing it back to Crowley, then, are you trying to find, and do you think it's possible to find actual concrete evidence of crimes at this point, or is that reduced to speculation at this point?
It would have to be in somebody's private library or in one of these institutions that knew of Crowley. I would love to go through Cambridge and Oxford's records and see if they had anything on Crowley about him returning and what was going on. Or I do know that the York collection is what I was talking about earlier. The York collection in
right.
has tons of information. I would like to go through that. And actually, the sons of Gerald York are still alive. And somebody has actually been in contact with him recently, somebody who was associated with Bruce Dickinson's Crowley movie, and that which was interesting. Bruce Dickinson.
There was Simon Callow, that one.
Yeah. The guy, Shrapnel, who played the kind of desiccated, corrupted old Crowley was outstanding. Really good. So I recommend at least watching that guy. But yeah, there were some flaws in that movie. But they went and visited the York brothers, who have Crowley's wand, and they actually have information I would love to read about Crowley that the dad did not put into the York collection. So there's stuff out there. There might be stuff out there. And the other thing is that Crowley talked in blinds, so all his magical stuff has fake, has weird terminology from occultism that means something. So, like, the chalice is a reference to a woman, the dove is a reference to, men's sexual stuff. So, there's all kinds of symbolism that he used. So there may be something in one of those old rituals that people need to kind of be taught what it really means, and that may be something that some of these guys in Pedo Gate are involved in, is one of these Crowley rituals that talks about drawing energy or something like that, and so there might be some. I mean, in my book in Children of the Beast, I talk about the soul cracking ritual that Hubbard did and got it from Hitler or from Crowley. So maybe these guys are learning something that's shielded from the public view, and so, there might be evidence. There might be something out there.
Would that make any difference, though? I mean, because it's like the stuff that I've been compiling that you'll be familiar with in Crowley's own writings, that's all, okay, it's de-emphasized, but it's known about. So you can present any of that, like the passage from the 1920 journal at Cephalou where I don't even want to quote it, it's so horrendous, but where he talks about raping an infant and that, that just doesn't hold any water with these people, because they just say, oh, that's just Crowley being Crowley and being shocking. And so, I think it would take a victim coming forward, and they're all dead by now.
Yeah.
Or what else? I suppose a document, like a government document.
Right. Somebody who investigated him. I mean, there were court cases and stuff like that, but yeah, I mean, I would say that the rituals, I don't know, the evidence of an actual crime, I think that there would be very little chance of that. But there may be references to criminal activity that aren't, the public hasn't seen yet.
I guess if Freedom of Information had him, but that wouldn't. I say they might have stuff on him as acting as an agent, but that's highly unlikely to be specific about what he was doing.
Yeah, do you know anything about Freedom of Information in the UK and how to access some of those old government records? I would love to see Crowley's SIS file.
No, I don't. I've always
if you go to the SIS file, like history, there's some kind of history website, and on there they just have a picture of Crowley and they say SIS agent, like they just admit it.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that to be pretty interesting. I'll have to find that reference.
Right.
But, yeah, so it's out there. I would love to see Crowley's file from the British government.
Yeah, for sure.
Where was that quote from about him raping a child? He said he raped a child in one of his magical records.
I was assuming that you were just familiar with that because it has been bandied around quite a lot. It's in the magical record of the beast, and it begins, her lewd lover or something. It's like written very poetically to, I guess, Herzig or Shumway, one of those two.
It's called Leah or something like that, right? Or...
It's not an actual poem. It's a journal entry. But he's describing, I don't know if I can bear to read it to you, but I'll, have you read those
I must have missed it.
Diaries?
I've read some of them. I've kind of poured through the magical record of the beast, but I didn't really, I didn't see a lot of that that was really of interest me when I was writing my books.
Okay, so it's August 12, 1920, Crowley wrote about his Scarlet Woman. Trigger warning for all listeners. It begins with, her breasts itch with lust of incest. She has given her 2-year bastard son to her lewd lover's whim of sodomy. Hath taught him speech and act, things infinitely abhorred with her own beastly carcass. She hath tongued her 5-month girl and asked its father to deflower it. She hath wished her beast to rape her rotten old mother, so far as woman clean of her. Then her blood is grown icy hard and cold with hate, and her eyes gleam as her ears ring with the chime of wedding bells, dirty words, or vibrate catgut fashion to the thin shrieks of a young child that her beast god slave mate is torturing for her pleasure, aye, and his own, since of her cup he drank and of her soul he breathed.
Wow, crazy.
Yeah.
I missed that. Can you send me that to my email?
Yes, I can. I've got the PDF as well if you want that.
I see. It's actually on your website. That's what pulled up.
Oh, is it? Well, I guess I'm wrong then that it's been bandied around a lot. So it's another example of something that... Yeah, because in the magical record of the beast, Simmons and Grant, they footnote a lot of stuff and they explain it. This has no footnote.
Wow.
There's no attempt to... Well... To put it in some context, your guess is as good as mine. But most people who you bring this up with, if they're Crowley defend or Crowley sympathizers, will just say, "Oh, that's Crowley being Crowley. He was just writing, torture porn ahead of his time."
Yeah, right. They probably have that up on the wall over at the Podesta House.